Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. And speaking of WPR, we're running our member drive right now. So it's your best chance to show this station how much Beta means to you with a donation. We would certainly appreciate it. To show our appreciation, we've lined up a handful of our favorite segments for you to enjoy. Let's get things going with a celebration of comedy legend Gilda Radner. Gilda was best known as one of the seven original Not Ready for Primetime players on Saturday Night Live. Her legacy has inspired the next wave of SNL cast members and comedians. Lisa Dapolito has created a documentary about Gilda's life and career. To tell her story, Lisa gained access to exclusive content from Gilda's journals, videos, and audio tapes.
Gilda's brother had had these boxes that were in storage since Gilda passed away, and he didn't really know what was in them. Mm-hmm. And it took a little convincing, but Gilda's best friend Judy and I convinced him to go into the storage unit and take his boxes out. And in the boxes were the first thing we found was a videotape that Gilda made while she was going through her chemotherapy.
Are you filming now?
Yes, dear.
Oh, I was panicked this time. I didn't want to come for this treatment. I thought if I filmed it, you know, it would add a dimension to take my mind off of it.
And then there were audio tapes in there and photos and her writings and journals. I mean, it took a period of, you know, several trips to Detroit to really get the nerve to, like, take, you know, it's a kind of weird when you have somebody's physical things.
Mm-hmm. If you didn't have access to all of this material, the film wouldn't have been nearly as successful as it is, don't you think?
I think it would have been a typical documentary about people talking about how great Gilda was, and it would show her sketches, and the modern-day comedians would talk about how they were inspired by her. But I think it would have been a traditional doc. So once I heard her her audio tapes, I was like, oh, my God, if Gilda could tell her story in her voice, that would be amazing.
I found that my comfort in live television was laughter. That I can do almost anything if people are laughing. That's what hugs me and holds me and gets things out of me.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
But one of the problems with it were the audio tapes were severely damaged. It was really, I was on a mission that Gilda was going to tell her story. And there were times that my team were telling me, like, oh, we'll just get an actress in and they could read Gilda's parts, or we can get somebody who plays, you know, you won't, the audience won't know the difference if you're using an actress. And I was like, no, it has to be Gilda. So with a lot of audio work and a lot of a team of an amazing dialogue restorer, I think it worked in the end.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered amongst all the material, the audio, the video recordings, the journal?
Well, I guess two things. Listening to Gilda talk, mm-hmm. She was obviously really funny in real life, but so intelligent and so acute of people and situations. But I think the most revealing thing was in her journals. Mm. And it was the journal, we use a bit of it in the film, which is about 1978. And it's at the height of Gilda's, her fame. She has an Emmy. She's on the cover of all these magazines. She checked herself into a hospital for her eating disorder, and she kept a diary about her loneliness.
Mm, yeah, right, yeah. You mentioned the importance of Gilda's childhood. Can you tell me a bit about her early years?
Well, Gilda was born to, I mean, her parents were very affluent, and her father was much older when she was born. And she was the apple of his eye. And it was a family that humor was very, very important in the family. So she was always entertaining her father. And I think she was also a chubby child. Uh-huh. So she was made fun of. And her mother put her on diet pills when she was young. So there was something that Gilda never felt. She always felt as an outsider. She felt overweight. And people made fun of her when she was little, and she was able to turn that around by making people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she also had a nanny from the time that she was born, and her nanny became a big influence in her life. And then when Gilda's her father died, it really when she was young, it really impacted her. She was always looking for that unconditional love that she got from her father. And I think that's why she had so many relationships with men, you know, maybe not the positive relationships, but she was always looking for that love, you know, whether it was a love of an audience or a love of a person. But that was really Gilda's quest, was always to find that sort of love.
She met Gene Wilder, who became her second husband. How did they meet?
Well, they met on the set of Hanky Panky.
What the hell are you doing in my apartment?
This is Nathan Curry's apartment.
You're a friend of Nathan Curry?
Yes. Who are you?
I'm Michael Jordan. He's got my apartment in Chicago. We exchanged apartments.
When did he leave?
I don't know when he left. I've been here a week. The agents in Chicago arranged for it. They didn't say anything about you.
Oh, I'm Kate Hellman. I'm sorry.
How do you
do? I thought you were a burglar.
I thought you were a burglar. Well, when you opened the door, I almost bashed your brains in.
What was Gilda and Gene's relationship like?
Gilda adored him. She wrote to him, you know, she wrote love stories to him. She talked about him all the time. She just adored him. So I always say that he really was the love of her life.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, from his point of view, he wrote a book. And I got to spend a day with Gene about a year before he died, which was pretty amazing. And he said to me he couldn't live with her and he couldn't live without her.
Huh.
And so I don't know. I mean, I think they're both – he was so sweet and so also childlike. So I could imagine they had a lot of fun.
On Monday, October 20th, the phone rang. It was my internist. He checked me into the hospital immediately for tests. He said, very calmly, "We've discovered there is a malignancy. I had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer."
How did she deal with this news?
Well, I think she had been, you know, we don't go into detail, that much detail in the film, because it is really hard to put like a whole story into somebody's life in an hour and a half. But she really was going to doctors for a while and not feeling well. And they were telling her that she was a hypochondriac or she had Epstein-Barr. Mm-hmm. And according to Gene's nephew, Jordan, she kept telling the doctors that she had cancer.
Mm.
And I think from what I heard, her diagnosis was really only a couple months to live. And she did wind up living 2.5 years and really sort of, you know, enjoying her life with Gene and with her friends and reconnecting with her SNL friends. So I think she was sad until, you know, she went to this place called the Wellness Community, which is the kind of the founding basis of Gilda's Club, and she met other people with cancer, and she was able to, you know, talk to people who were going through the same things that she was going through.
Mm-hmm. While she was sick, Gilda decided that she wanted to make cancer funny, so she asked for help from her old SNL writing partner, Alan Zweibel. How did Alan help Gilda make cancer funny?
Well, Alan and Gilda were really, after Gilda... Gilda had a long period of time, or at the beginning periods of Gene, she wasn't really with the SNL crowd, but her and Alan were always friends through thick and thin. And Alan was working on a show called It's Gary Shandling Show, and Gilda was supposed to be on the show before she was sick, actually, and or when she just got sick. And so she did a guest appearance on the show, and she makes fun of cancer. So her and Alan worked on their script. And I think, you know, I love the fact that Gilda was able to go back on television, was able to talk about cancer, and had that moment.
Hi, Gary.
Oh, Gilda, it's Gilda Radner, everybody.
Good. Don't milk the applause like that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I haven't been on television for a while.
Oh, that, yeah. What was wrong?
Oh, I had cancer. What did you have?
Oh. It's funny, and also it's poignant. It's a very memorable scene. What do you think is Gilda Radner's legacy?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so many comedians, so many people in comedy are inspired by her.
Yeah.
She has a really solid place, I think. You know, she was inspired by, in terms of women, but also she inspires many, many people like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Tina Fey, who are inspiring now a new generation of comedians who will inspire a new generation. So I think she has a pretty solid legacy there. And then in terms of Gilda's clubs, you know, there's 18 of them. There's hundreds of thousands of people through the years who have been helped by these programs. So I think she has a pretty interesting legacy.
Lisa Dapolito is the director of the Gilda Radner documentary, Love Gilda. Gilda is one of the best-loved and most memorable comedians of all time. These conversations with and about creative personalities who inspire are something that we enjoy sharing with you on Beta every week. We're only able to do this with your support. So please consider a gift of any amount right now to show your love for Beta. Here's someone to tell you how. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd like to take a moment to thank those of you who have shown your support for the show already and urge those of you who haven't to do so now. Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. We spoke to Matt about his online project, Hate Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. We started our conversation by talking about Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent: The Political Economy of the Mass Media. This book was a big influence on Matt.
It had a huge impact on me because I had grown up in a family of journalists, and I had never thought that there was a propaganda aspect to American journalism. That book was a real eye-opener for me, and it became a guide in my own career. It really describes how propaganda works in America. Obviously, we don't have a system of political commissars who come in and delete your copy, but we do have a lot of internal pressures and unseen propaganda ideas that artificially narrow the conversation, and that's what that book was about.
You've described your new serialized book, Hate Inc., as a rethink of manufacturing consent. Why do you think it needs rethinking?
Well, because that book came out in 1988, just before a whole bunch of really revolutionary things happened to the commercial media system in America. There was the advent of the 24-hour news cycle. The internet was on the way. And then there was a significant business change that was really innovated by networks like Fox News, which was really about segmenting the news audience into different demographics and capturing them, you know, as opposed to going for the widest possible audience. So Chomsky and Herman were really writing about a very different time in American media, and I thought that in this new landscape that's very fragmented and atomized, it would be worth looking to see how their propaganda model held up over time.
So is there one recurring theme that runs through Hate Inc.?
Yes. I think the main theme that runs through the book is that we in the commercial media now are financially incentivized to wind people up and make them angry with each other. Whereas in the old days of media, back in the days when we had three networks and just a couple of newspaper chains, we had exactly the opposite dynamic in media. The idea was to make the audiences less wound up and actually more placid because we were trying to reach the widest possible audience. Now what we do is we have a divided demographic where, you know, MSNBC goes after liberals, Fox goes after conservatives, and the easiest financial route to success is just making those groups angry with each other.
And as you say in the book, it's also important to ask people to talk about whatever they want to talk about, not just one thing in particular.
Right, and this is something that's really been lost in the modern age of reporting, where what happens more often than not now is people sit down and do stories and they look for links to support a thesis that they already have, whereas the old school of reporting is you just sort of talk to people all the time and you ask them open-ended questions and they tell you, they offer you what they know about things. And so you're not looking for a predetermined thesis. You're not trying to get quotes to fill in a blank that you've already laid out on paper.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference. The idea of physically talking to people making it an open-ended conversation as opposed to what we do now.
You've used sports analogies to describe presidential campaigns. You've said that the preseason is the straw polls, the regular season is the primaries, and the playoffs are the general election. So it only makes sense that you argue that the media industrial complex has turned the news into sports. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. One of the things is that sports is a format that definitely works commercially, that the networks are familiar with. They know how to sell it. They know how to market it. And we've stolen a lot of things from how we cover sports and transplanted it onto presidential campaigning. You see that a lot, especially on election nights. If you watch election coverage on the cable networks, you'll see that the setup on the sets is almost exactly like a Sunday countdown show for the NFL.
Yeah.
You'll have one analyst from one team, one analyst from another team, and then there are people who make predictions about which team is going to win, and everything becomes about the horse race. We borrow a lot of the language and the stylistic aspects of sports coverage for things like debates, which are just chock full of boxing metaphors from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just a formula because it's easier to train audiences to understand politics as something that they have to root for, as opposed to trying to train them to think in a nuanced way about a very, very difficult subject.
You have this great trick that you've trained yourself to use before you click on any news story online. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I imagine that I'm opening a box of cigarettes, and it's basically if I'm going to go outside and have an MSNBC or have a Fox or something like that.
Yeah.
Because here's what people don't think about when they watch the news. They forget that it's a consumer product.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, almost everything else that we buy, we have a heightened sense of consumer awareness these days, whether it's, you know, we watch what we eat, where people are vegans, they count the calories of everything, they think about the products and what's in the furniture that their kids use, but they don't think about what the news is. The news is a consumer product. It's both something that you consume, and you yourself are also a product because the media company is taking the information that it's getting about your news habits, and it's selling it off to a third party. So you're in the middle of a very complex consumer transaction every time you watch any news content, and people don't think about that. They think the news is just a bunch of people trying to tell you the truth about stuff, but it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. So if the news is indeed a consumer product, as you argue, does that cheapen your profession and make it more difficult for you to get motivated to devote so much time and effort to writing stories?
Yes and no. I mean, there's still, I think most of the people who do this job, most of the good reporters that I know, they didn't get into this because they wanted to get rich and make a consumer product for a large transnational corporation, which actually most of us end up working for. You know, most of us got into this profession because we wanted to be truth tellers or be writers or make good TV or whatever it is. So we're motivated by the same things that motivated people like Seymour Hersh and Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and Terry Southern and Hunter Thompson, all those people. And, you know, they didn't have commercial motivations, but we're working within a framework that is increasingly commercial. So it's difficult. I think it's in the old days when you were working in the 50s and 60s in media in America, there wasn't the expectation that news had to make money. News was very frequently a loss leader within a bigger company that made money in some other way. Now that's not true. Now if you work for the news, you have to have some kind of successful commercial formula, and that affects everybody's work.
Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist. He's also the author of Hate, Inc., Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. If you enjoy hearing provocative ideas from authors like Matt, now is the perfect time to show your support. Your contribution goes a long way to ensure that Beta is able to keep delivering these kinds of insightful ideas to you every week. So please think about making a gift to WPR. Here's how you can do it. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to this special edition of Beta. Thanks very much to those of you who have contributed this hour. And if you'd like to contribute, now would be a great time because we're rapidly approaching the end of the hour. Shadrach Kabengo is better known as the hip-hop artist Shad. He's also the host of the Netflix docuseries Hip Hop Evolution. The series won a Peabody Award in 2016. The juror said it chronicled how music born in the poorest neighborhoods of urban America became a global phenomenon. Shad says that it all started on August 11th, 1973.
It's considered the birth of hip-hop because Kool Herc played particular records in a particular style that is kind of the backbone of hip-hop. And what that style is a mix of records from different genres. And he was playing the sections of records that they called breaks. So it was the breakdown part of the record, usually a breakdown of drums and bass or something like that, some funky kind of percussion.
I've never seen anyone have two copies of a record and keep going back to the part where we normally would pick the needle up and put it back. So there's this silence for a minute. Now that was continuous. And he called it the merry-go-round.
Yeah, it was hip-hop's Big Bang moment. And I've read that DJ Kool Herc, he plays two copies of James Brown's 1970 album Sex Machine and did a cut and mix of the percussion breakdown from the song Give It Up or Turn It Loose. Is that right?
Well, the funny thing is, to this day, you can see it in hip-hop evolution, like, Kool Herc doesn't like to talk about the particular records that he played because that's how DJs were at that time, right? You could call James Brown really a godfather of hip-hop because his break beats are so fundamental, foundational to the music.
Who were some of the other early DJs that contributed to the birth of this new kind of music?
Yeah, well, the kind of the accepted trinity is Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Flash. Mm. Bambaataa, one thing he's credited with is bringing community into it, is bringing this sort of ethos of hip-hop being about unity and about knowledge and empowerment. And then Grandmaster Flash, I think you could speak of him as like the real technical innovator, because what he did was he made that whole looping thing with the breakbeats super smooth.
Most DJs, they concentrated their efforts on the tone arm. It would be totally sloppy offbeat, and I seen a lot of that. I knew there has to be a better way. And after trying many different things, I placed my fingers on the vinyl. I let it go, stopped it. Let it go, stop it. I said to myself, I have absolute control of the record.
And then how did the rhymes, the lyrics, the rapping, how did that start?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in the documentary, what we talk about is how, well, in a sense, that's been around for a long time. Obviously, the use of the voice in a rhythmic way, call and response kind of way, that goes back to a lot of different traditions. But with hip hop specifically, we talked to Coke LaRock, who was the MC at Kool Herc's parties. And so in those really early times, the DJ is really what people came to the party for. And the MC was the guy kind of bigging up the DJ, shouting out people at the party, just creating a kind of party atmosphere. And then that sort of evolved to more people getting on the mic and doing their little couplets and groups. So crews were a big thing in the early days of hip hop. So that evolved to, you know, 2-3 people doing a routine together to kind of get the party going. But ultimately, it was when the music went on record that the voice became the prominent thing, and people were looking at rappers as kind of the core of the culture.
Yeah. Let's fast forward a few years to 1979 then, and the hip-hop track Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. What role did this song play in the history of hip-hop?
Yeah, huge. A really interesting story, because hip-hop at that time, you know, it was a spontaneous thing. And a lot of the people that were at the forefront at that time in the Bronx and in Harlem, they didn't really imagine this being something you could capture on record. And Rapper's Delight was that first record. I think it sold like 20 million copies. I mean, it just, but there was a record producer, and she put together a group of kids she met in New Jersey.
Yeah, and what's her name? I can't remember her name.
Sylvia
Robinson?
Robinson.
Yeah, that's right.
So these weren't kids that were part of the crews that everybody involved with hip-hop knew, and they put this record together, and it took over the world. It really spread hip-hop everywhere. If you go to other cities, that's where they encountered hip-hop.
Yeah,
outside of New York, they encountered hip-hop with Rapper's Delight.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat, and me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet.
What did other New York MCs think of it?
They hated it. They really, really hated it.
Like, what are they doing to our art form? You know what I mean? It's like, this is the first introduction that people get to what we do, to what we've been doing for like 7 years.
You hated it.
Rapper's Delight was, as you say, the nation's introduction to hip-hop, and it was kind of a compilation of lyrics from that scene that created a seismic sonic shift in 1982 when Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five released The Message. Can you tell me a bit about this song and how it redefined hip-hop?
The Message spoke to what was going on in the community in a really frank and poetic way.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
It's information, it's game, it's knowledge. That was very attractive to me.
It was reaching down to kids like me and saying, hey, this is where you're gonna end up if you don't have a plan.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
When we think about hip-hop now, we think about it as, you know, like Chuck D said, the CNN of the street. You know, we think about it as music with a message. It absolutely opened up possibilities for hip-hop music.
In one episode of Hip Hop Evolution, you describe Run DMC as the Beatles of hip-hop. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think they were the first real hip-hop stars, firstly because of, you know, the big records that they had, but also because of their style. So they dressed the way people dressed in the streets. They really carried that whole aesthetic, and then combine that with the hit records, My Adidas, Sucker MCs, It's Like That, and then, of course, it's like they were, hip-hop's first rock stars, I'd say.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Run-DMC was part of hip-hop's so-called golden age. What was it about this time, the mid to late 80s, that made it such a great time for hip-hop?
Yeah, well, what people love about that era is that the genre just evolved so much and so quickly. And every time an artist would come out during that era, whether it was Rakim or De La Soul or A Tribe Called Quest, Public Enemy, certainly. So it's like this rapid evolution of the music. So many new styles got introduced. So people really consider that to be the golden age of hip-hop.
I think hip-hop is now known as much for its political power as it is for its party preparedness. I'm thinking especially of a group like Public Enemy. How did Public Enemy influence hip-hop?
Well, let's start with sonically. You know, they really just came with the Bomb Squad, the production team. You got these textures musically that were just so powerful. And then you had Chuck D, who was this amazing MC with this big booming voice and a really strong, clear message. And they inspired so many people after them. So, yeah, Public Enemy is a game changer, one of the greatest groups ever in hip-hop.
Yeah. As the 80s became the 90s, gangster rap attracted a lot of attention, and it was also a product of Los Angeles. So how significant was it for hip-hop to become bi-coastal?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's difficult to remember these things now. Hip-hop was very New York-centric. So when gangster rap emerged, I think one of the most significant things about it was this L.A. movement. It became the dominant kind of subgenre of hip-hop. It was killing it on the charts with the record sales and getting a ton of media attention because the content was so hardcore, and that was absolutely the product of the realities in Los Angeles of gang life there and all the violence there and the police brutality there. And it spoke to that stuff with a frankness and with a sonic heft that people hadn't heard before.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
And speaking of gangster rap, one of the most influential and controversial groups at that time was N.W.A.
Yeah, N.W.A., everything from their name to their big hit, F the Police, very upfront, guns in the videos. And it woke up a lot of people to the realities of what was going on in L.A. specifically, but in the inner city in a lot of places.
In a review for Daily Dot, a critic named Caron Spearman wrote that it was unacceptable that your series didn't feature any women artists, not even crucial pioneers like Salt-N-Pepa, MC Light, or Queen Latifah. What's your response to his critique?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we know that was a big failure of the first season. Not that we didn't try, but you know, we weren't able to land some interviews with some of the major women that were there. Yeah, that was a huge failure of the first season, and we tried to, and we're trying to remedy that a bit the second season and so on. Yeah. Women have been around since the beginning of hip-hop, in the earliest crews, and that should have been represented in season one, and it's represented a bit more in season two.
Some think that we can't flow. Stereotypes, they got to go. I'ma mess around and flip the scene into reverse.
With what?
With a little touch of late first.
Shadrack Kabango is a hip-hop artist and the host of the Netflix docuseries Hip-Hop Evolution. We hope you have the same passion for Beta that Shad does for hip-hop. You can become one of our alphas and a member of WPR at the same time right now with your gift of any amount. Your support will go a long way to help ensure that all of your favorite Wisconsin Public Radio weekend shows, including Beta, will be there each and every week. Here's someone who can help. And thanks.